Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Apple bias. Today is Sunday, November 15th, 2020, and this is show number 810. Well, it wouldn't be an Apple announcement week without Lori Gill joining us on Chit Chat Across the Pond. She is the managing editor of iMore, and we have such a blast together. It's been so fun that we've had this many separate announcements going on because it was an excuse to just talk to Lori every month. Anyway, Lori and I start the conversation by talking about what all of the new M1 Macs have in common, which is much more than we're used to seeing between models. Then we talk about what system on a chip, or SoC, actually means and why it is so important to us. There's a very subtle but possibly important difference between the 256GB and 512GB storage models of the MacBook Air, which makes it even more interesting to help us decide between the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pros that were just announced. We explore why Apple never said the word gigahertz and how that makes the nerds crazy because we can't compare the models to the previous Intel-based Macs. We explore the future just a bit and then start dreaming of the next models Apple will release. You can find this episode in your podcatcher of choice if you subscribe to Chit Chat Across the Pond Lite, or of course, you can listen over at podfeet.com. Well, this week, I also had the great pleasure of being a guest on Ken Ray's In a Few Minutes podcast to talk about the One More Thing event. As he described it, topics include a lack of terminology, whether now is the term to buy, and drinking. Mostly it's technology talk. Anyway, we had a lot of fun, so go subscribe in your podcatcher of choice to In a Few Minutes and give that a listen. And in the category of One More Thing, if you want to find out what studio quality microphones in the 16-inch MacBook Pro sound like, listen closely to me on Ken's show. I had the wrong input to Skype, and it was using my internal 16-inch MacBook Pro's microphones, and he did not even notice. It's not my big girl mic, but you know what? It's not awful either. You know how sometimes you buy something and deep down you realize that maybe it really wasn't as great as you thought it was, but you justify your purchase anyway because otherwise you'd realize that you did something really dumb? Well, I read about this very thing in the book Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. Because of this, I often wonder whether something is as good as I'm pretending it to be. Take, for example, the Apple Pencil. It's $129, and it seems like a product most people could easily live without. People are crazy about the new Magic Keyboard for iPad because, you know what, we really don't want to write by hand. We want to type because it's more efficient, and there aren't that many ways you can communicate in handwritten script anyway. But let's say you think you might want to write with a stylus, but $129 seems an excessive price for what's probably going to be only an occasional use item. I wrote an article in 2019 entitled One Crayon is Better Than Two Pencils, in which I explained all of the virtues of the Logitech crayon at $70. I still think the crayon is a great device at a great price, but I can now say without hesitation that the Apple Pencil is way better, at least for me. The reason I know this to be true is because I lost my Apple Pencil, and I was shocked by how much it annoyed me not to have it. I don't lose things very often because I put things in their place when I'm done with them, unlike some people I know who shall remain unnamed at this point. I'm so good at keeping track of my things that I remember the very last thing I was doing with my pencil before it disappeared. I was sitting on the couch in our family room, and I was starting to take notes for an article about how the new scribble feature in iPad OS 14 isn't really very good. I never got to finish the article because the next time I went to work on it, my Apple Pencil was gone. Now, the cool part of the Apple Pencil 2 is that it sticks via a magnet to the top edge of the iPad. It works well, but it does get knocked off inadvertently when I throw the iPad in my backpack. But you know what? I hadn't gone anywhere. I didn't take my iPad in my backpack anywhere after that article and before I lost it. I've become quite adept at crawling under the recliner portion of our couch without hurting myself. It's dangerous because there's these spiky things hanging down. And I use my iPhone as a flashlight because while I don't lose things often, things are always falling between the couch cushions. Usually it's my crochet hook, but on occasion it's been a phone. And, you know, it happens a lot. So I crawled under there and under Steve's recliner and even under the other two recliners. It's a really cool couch, but no success. I searched all around my bed because I do play with my iPad while sipping my first cup of coffee in the morning, but it wasn't there either. Steve checked under the refrigerator, thinking one of our rotten cats might have stolen it and knocked it under there. He even looked under the seats in both cars, even though we hadn't been anywhere since I'd lost it. I paid a few dollars for an app called Bluetooth Finder, which is supposed to help you find missing Bluetooth devices. I think the app works because it found lots of Bluetooth devices in my house. In fact, it said I had a tile in my house, and I didn't believe that, but I used its little meter to find out where it thought it was, and sure enough, there was one in my purse. I forgot all about them giving me one at CES. I lived without my Apple Pencil for 2 weeks, trying to use the Logitech crayon instead, and I actually hated the experience. I can finally articulate why the Apple Pencil is way better. It's because it's stuck to the iPad. Seriously, if I have a need to do something, it's just there. I remember I wanted to show Steve something that required the pencil, and I realized my purse was on another level in the house. I had to go get it, and by that time, I had lost his attention. The other thing is, because it's right there, it's also always fully charged. The battery on the crayon is pretty good, but when it runs out, I have to find a lightning cable, and if it's USB-A, I have to find a dongle so I can plug it into my iPad or my Mac. That happened a couple of times, and it was super annoying. It surprised me how much I really use the pencil, too. I've told you before how I use Notability to write out my ideas when I'm programming because I can scribble in shorthand quickly before I lose a thought and change colors for different ideas and use red for dangerous things I'm doing in my coding. I'm working on a new crocheted blanket, and the pattern is giving me fits. It's not a hard pattern, but it has very slight changes, so it's hard to keep track of which step I've done. I wanted to use Notability with pencil to hand write out the instructions in a more structured way than the real instructions, and then be able to check off each step instead of having do this 3 times and do that 4 times where I couldn't keep count. I also figured out a really good use for Apple Pencil, and that's for creating handwritten physical notes. Here's the problem to be solved. Have you tried to write a handwritten note by hand lately? If you're anything like me, your penmanship has atrophied over the years. I make so many mistakes, sending a simple thank you note looks like a 4-year-old wrote it. And I totally forget about writing in a straight line. I mean, there's no way I can do that. It all just kind of slides down like some kind of psychopath. So here's the trick. Again, using my trusty Notability, I set it for white paper with nicely spaced lines on it. I choose a blue pen, which will later on look like I wrote with a real pen. I write my note using the eraser as often as I use the pen. Sometimes I have an idea I wish I'd written earlier in the note. With Notability, I can use the lasso to select some handwriting and simply move it around. When I'm done, I turn off the lines, put some pretty notepaper in my printer, and I print it out right from the iPad. Now I have a physical letter to send to someone that looks like a normal handwritten note, and yet I couldn't have made it look this good in 100 years without the iPad and Apple Pencil. My mother-in-law has been the recipient of a few of my notes, and she says she's keeping them forever because handwritten notes are a lost art. Well, for 2 weeks, I searched for my beloved pencil. I even asked Twitter and Slack where they hid it, and I got some great suggestions, like Rick Cartwright's, where he suggested maybe it got stuck magnetically to something else. I hadn't thought of that. That meant yet another crawl under my recliners, running my hands all along the steel mechanism, feeling for my pencil, and yet I didn't find my pencil. I finally broke down and I bought a new one, but at least I was able to find one in the Apple refurb store, so that knocked $20 off the price. I got it, and I am so happy to have my pencil back. And yes, I fully expect to find my original one immediately. It's like they say that the best camera is the one you have with you. I think the best stylus is the one that's stuck to your iPad. Okay, I'm going to make a really quick real-time amendment. Rick Cartwright is in the chat room and in the live show, and he says it was not his idea to check for the pencil connected to something magnetically. So someone else wonderful made that suggestion, and I inadvertently gave him credit. And I give credit to Rick for admitting that it wasn't him. So my apologies to whoever did tell it to me, but I thank you for your idea.
Hi there, Castaways. Terry Austin here, online professor since 2012, way before the pandemic. Let's talk about a problem to be solved that I deal with pretty much every day, making videos for my online classes. Many of these videos involve me taking my students or other faculty that I consult with on video-based tours of websites. My daily workhorse monitor is an HP Envy ultra-wide curved display, which usually sets to the right of my 2020 16-inch MacBook Pro. This beast of a monitor has a 21:9 ratio, with a resolution of 3440 by 1440. Sitting in front of this screen is frankly amazing, but to try and watch a video in that format at full resolution would be painful. The monitor's really wide and short, and all the fonts are tiny in a video shot in native format. So, in comes PixelSnap. For all you setup users, PixelSnap is part of the gang. Load it up and give it a spin. If you're not a setup user, you can still get PixelSnap. Easy to remember, just go to getpixelsnap.com. For a single Mac, the cost is $39, which makes me appreciate setup that much more. Let's get to business, though, and walk through how this works. As I prepare to shoot a video, I open a web page or app in a window that I want to shoot anywhere on my screen. Then I open PixelSnap and issue the Find Dimensions command, which gives me a crosshair cursor. I move that cursor to the top left of my browser or app window. Personally, I don't want the navigation bar from the browser in the windows, so I go just below that to the main part of the web page. From there, I click and hold the mouse and start dragging. A pale red rectangle appears, and in the center, I see an ever-changing resolution indicator that changes as I continue to drag. Once I have the rectangle at precisely the resolution I want for my final video, and for me that's usually 1920 by 1080, but it could be anything you want, I stop. Now the magic begins. With the keystroke Command-Shift-F, the translucent red rectangle freezes in place. I then grab the corner of my web page and drag it to match that rectangle precisely. Then I go back to the menu bar and tell PixelSnap to clear all, and the red rectangle goes away, leaving me with a perfectly sized web page ready for recording at exactly the resolution I want for my final video. From there, I'm ready to fire up my favorite video recording app, which for me is ScreenFlow, in the reassurance that the area I'm interested in is precisely the right resolution for my final video. And there you have it, problem solved. It makes no difference what monitor I'm working on, how unwieldy it might be for the final viewer. I know their video that they're going to watch from me is going to be scaled exactly right for them.
Well, you know, guys, I was so intrigued by Terry's description of PixelSnap that I downloaded it from SetApp to see for myself. I wanted to add a caveat to his review and add a little bit more about the app as I discovered over time that it can do a bunch of other stuff. Terry's monitor, as he said, is 3440 by 1440, which is not a 4K display, nor is it what Apple calls a Retina display. It's huge and it's perfect for him. But if you try to use PixelSnap to do what Terry did using the internal display on a MacBook or using a 4K or a 5K display, you will not get the same results. Back in OS X 10.9, Apple started using a technology called pixel doubling on the higher resolution monitors. Enabling pixel doubling simply draws every pixel in the desktop as a 2x2 block of pixels on the screen. This makes everything exactly twice the size. The problem is, without pixel doubling, everything on a 4K or a Retina screen would be wee tiny, especially the menu bar text. The reason I bring up pixel doubling is that if you follow Terry's instructions and you're using a Retina or 4 or 5K display, you get a video twice the size of what PixelSnap said you were capturing. I tested PixelSnap by creating a pink box. He calls it a light red box, but it's pink. Anyway, I tested it by creating this pink box on that was 640 by 480 on my 16-inch MacBook Pro's display. I then dragged my window over the box and recorded just that window. The resulting video was 1280 by 960 instead of 640 by 480. Oddly, QuickTime says it was actually 1280 by 958, so I don't know, a pixel got dropped along the way, and then got doubled. Anyway, at first I was dismayed, thinking PixelSnap wouldn't be as useful to do what he was talking about as I'd hoped, but I gave a poke at the preferences and found a setting labeled Retina, and the dropdown next to it is defaulted to points, parentheses, rounded. Not sure what rounded means. Maybe that's the rounding and that's how we lost a digit. I don't know. But anyway, it's set to points. And there's a non-rounded option of points as well. But then there's also an option for screen pixels. If you're using a Retina or 4 or 5K display, simply change the recording to use screen pixels. And you'll be able to correctly match your recording area to match your desired output recording dimensions. Now, Terry's problem to be solved is quite clever, but I think Pixel Snap's main purpose is to allow you to measure things on screen. For example, as a web developer, you may find times where things aren't lining up quite right, and you'd like to know the actual measurement between elements. Pixel Snap is designed for this task. With Pixel Snap enabled by the keystroke Command-Shift-F, as Terry described, you get red crosshairs on screen. You will also see two numbers, which are the horizontal and vertical dimensions it's detecting. This can be the distance between two images, or between some text and an image, or if you hover over a graphical element, it will show you the size of that element. For example, if you hover over a folder in macOS, say on the desktop, you'll see that the icon is 59 pixels wide by 36 pixels tall. This is very clumsy to explain how this works, but it's completely intuitive when you're using it. You have a couple of options when showing these dimensions. If you hit the Enter key, the dimensions are copied to your clipboard. There are a couple of things that it took me a while to figure out. When testing Pixel Snap for this addendum to Terry's review, I noticed that the touch bar on my MacBook Pro had been activated with a couple of buttons. As I described before, moving the cursor around, you have an actively changing set of dimensions showing. But touch bar gives me two buttons which allow me to freeze either the horizontal or vertical dimension on screen. In fact, I can keep tapping it to get many different dimensions recorded. There's also a horizontal and vertical button on the touch bar that gives me a line that goes all the way across my screen, horizontally or vertically, depending on which one I click, and it shows its absolute distance from the edge. If I click on screen, it sticks there. It freezes right there on screen, so I can have a vertical alignment bar. Both of these sets of options seemed useful, but I couldn't find any instructions on how to leave the dimensions on screen without the touch bar. I looked at all the options and preferences, and while I did find some keystrokes under shortcuts, I didn't find any clues on how to execute the options enabled in the touch bar. I did discover that if you drag across an area, creating that pink box Terry talked about up front, you can use the C key to copy a screenshot to the clipboard, or the S key to save a screenshot to your desktop. But I still didn't know how to activate those options that I had over on Touch Bar. I finally resorted to holding down all kinds of keys. I held down Option, Control, Command while clicking, none of which did a darn thing. And finally, I just started poking every key on my keyboard like I was a two-year-old. I did discover that the V key freezes the vertical dimension and the H key freezes the horizontal dimension. Now that, like a young child, I had smashed all of the keys I could think of, I resorted to watching their introductory video. They showed a contextual menu pop-up, which made me realize that a command or right-click displays a menu for adding the horizontal or vertical guide. That's the one that goes full length or full width that I've been looking for, and for freezing horizontal or vertical distances on screen. Not only that, it showed that Shift-H and Shift-V are how you freeze the guides on screen if you don't have a touch bar. Maybe I should have watched the video up front when they offered it on the opening screen. But even after watching the video, it still took me a bit to figure out how to get the guides to stick on screen. You hit the keystrokes, such as Shift-V for the vertical guide, and you'll see the guide, but to get it to stick, you have to click on screen. It will immediately revert back to measuring, so you have to do a second Shift-V if you want a second guide to stick on screen. Another thing I realized watching the video is that Pixel Snap has object detection given the right kind of background. This means you can simply drag across an icon on a white background and the dimensions will snap right to the edges and leave the dimensions right on screen. I tested this on the Programming by Stealth logo, which has the squirrely brackets and the little dimension indicator slid right along them going in and out of the squirrely brackets as I went up and down the bracket. That was pretty amazing. Now, I said it has to be a light background, or I think it has to be a contrasting background. I tried it with the buttons that I have that are on the gray picture of a MacBook cover and the lid of a MacBook, and it couldn't really find the edges of those buttons. So that's why I think you have to be on maybe a higher contrast than that. Sometimes when you're working with Pixel Snap, it might grab the wrong content, especially if you're measuring between lines of text. Pixel Snap allows you to adjust the tolerance, either in the preferences or by simply using the T key to flip between the high, medium, low, and zero tolerance levels. I found the T key to be invaluable to adjust quickly to just the kind of dimension I was trying to capture. Now I want to re-mention one thing Terry said way back before I butted in on his review. After you've plopped dimensions and guides all over your screen, hitting Command-Shift-F again gets you out of Pixel Snap, but the dimensions and the guides stick all over your screen. You have to go back up to the menu bar app and select Clear All, just like Terry said. If you find it tedious to go all the way up to the menu bar like I do, you can add a keystroke to Clear All in the preferences of Pixel Snap. Pixel Snap also integrates with four applications: Sketch from Google, Adobe XD, Figma, and the Affinity Suite. If you enable any of these integrations, Pixel Snap says it will get the correct dimensions based on the in-app zoom level. I turned it on for the Affinity Suite and was instructed that Pixel Snap would have to be set to points rather than screen pixels. I didn't test it, but I'd be curious here to see if it would truly get the correct dimensions on a Retina or 4K or 5K display. The bottom line is that I haven't ever seen an app do what Pixel Snap can do. It does it elegantly, and it's so unusual, I'm surprised it's even allowed to do what it does. If you don't have a setup subscription, you can buy Pixel Snap for $39 for one Mac, and they have prices for more Macs, and it's available from getpixelsnap.com. I talk often about how much I appreciate the people who help financially to support the podcast through Patreon and PayPal. And I have to say, I am equally as grateful to people like Terry who support the show by doing listener reviews. You know, I love doing the podcast and I love writing and I love testing out new products. But I also love free time to take long walks, wash my car, and do programming. What Terry and all of the other wonderful contributors give me is time and the peace of mind that the listeners will have an interesting content even though I didn't have to do all the work. So thank you to all of you, those who have contributed. And if you've been trying to get up your nerve to try it yourself, please do it. Okay, we have some late breaking news from the chat room. Rick Cartwright says it was Rick Abraham who said that I should check for something my magnetic pencil would have stuck to. So I was right, it was Rick. I just got the wrong Rick. And so thank you, Rick Abraham. For many Nocilla castaways, a dark day in our tech lives was when our beloved app Clarify was end-of-lifed by its developers. I was personally heartbroken because I'd not only advertised for the product on the show, I was a devout user of Clarify for all of the tutorials I've made for podfeet.com and for my friends and my family. One part of the beauty of Clarify was that it let you rapidly take a series of screenshots as you walk through a tool or a website, annotate the screenshots with arrows and lines and even sequence numbers, and then add text to each step, including HTML links and code blocks. But the biggest advantage over using Clarify versus just taking normal screenshots and annotating them in something like, you know, Preview, was that it would export your step-by-step instructions into beautifully formatted PDFs, HTML pages, or even Word or PowerPoint. You never had to go through the absolute tedium of trying to move images around in a text editor and getting the pages to flow properly. Clarify did all of this for you. After Clarify hit end of life, the developers did one last update to make it 64-bit, so at least those of us who already own Clarify could keep using it with macOS Catalina and beyond. But you couldn't buy Clarify any longer. I noticed that the demise of Clarify, even though my copy is still working, caused me to simply stop making tutorials. I just don't do it anymore. I really do think it broke my heart that Clarify was abandoned. In April of 2018, I wrote an article entitled, Can Stepshot Guides Replace Clarify? I tried to write it as optimistically as I could, but Stepshot Guides was very expensive at $120 per year, and it was very clumsy, and I really didn't like it. And Stepshot Guides was eventually abandoned by the developers. Now, why am I opening these old wounds? This week, I was contacted by Oleksiy Shrebinyi, about his app called Folge, that's F-O-L-G-E, at folge.me. He's marketing this as a replacement for Clarify and Stepshot Guides. Over the years, I'm often asked if I found a replacement for Clarify, and I surely miss it myself, so I was excited to give Folge a try. I want to say up front that Oleksiy is possibly the most responsive and excited about his product developer that I have ever encountered. He loves feedback, and the more detailed, the better. He said he's always disappointed when users write something simple like, I like your tool, or something equally vague. He has met his match with me. I've been sending in questions and screenshots and even a little video recording to show him what I'm finding, and I've only been using it for a day. Let's talk first about the Folge interface. The app is written in Electron, which means it's basically a Chrome web app. The advantage of Electron is it allows him very rapid development, and it allows Alexei to have his app work on both Windows and Mac without having to develop separate apps. I recognized right away that he uses Bootstrap to do the design, which is a tool Bart taught us in Programming by Stealth. The result is a very fluid, beautiful, and quick app. Now, Electron apps are generally seen as heavier than native apps, but I'm not noticing this being slow at all. What I do notice is that the normal Mac menu bar options basically don't do anything at all. For example, there isn't a preferences menu in the menu bar. Instead, you go to settings using a hamburger menu like you would on a web app. It's also odd that there are undo and redo menus in the menu bar, and yet those functions don't work inside Folge. Once I understood this, though, I didn't find it as annoying as you would think because I'm so used to working in the web. But I did want to make sure you understood upfront how Folge might look different than normal apps. Now, I usually like to wait till the end to tell you the price of a tool, so if I really like it, I can sell you on it first. But since I mentioned the high price of Stepshot Guides, and we know that the $39 price tag of Clarify wasn't enough to make a sustainable business model, I figured I should let you know the pricing for Folge. Folge is available for download at folge.me, as I said, and they have both a free and a paid model. With the free version, you're limited to simply PDF export, and your screenshots will have a small typewritten watermark in the bottom right corner saying they were taken by Folge. The normal price for a personal license for Folge is 80 euro, but he's got it on sale right now for 25% off, so it's only 59 euro. For the US folks, the regular price will be $93, which still, I think that's a fair price, but it's on sale right now for $69, and that sale is till the end of November. Now that you know the price, let's talk about the tool. Folge has a unique method for taking screenshots. It is definitely a much different workflow than using Clarify, but hopefully it will be just a case of needing to retrain my muscle memory to use this. When you first start using Folge, you'll be shown the settings page. This is very important to how Folge captures screenshots. Once you're in screenshot mode in Folge, by default, screenshots are initiated by a simple click of the mouse. The screenshot will then have a red shadowed rectangle on it precisely where you clicked. I think the idea is that if you're showing someone a step in a guide, you probably want to tell them where to click. So having a little red box there would be a good idea. However, I found this very hard to get used to, and I kept creating errant screenshots with these rectangles on them, and I had to do a lot of cleanup after the fact. The rectangles were never quite where I wanted them, and they weren't formatted the way I prefer, and I find it much easier to add them myself after taking the screenshots. Luckily, in the settings screen that you're shown upon launch, and which you can access at any time using the hamburger menu, you can change the mode to capture with a mouse click and a key pressed, and you can disable the show clicked area toggle that puts those red rectangles in. Maybe you would like it that way, and I'm not trying to sell you on the way I like it, but I like that you can change it to the way you prefer. Now that I have the settings the way I prefer, let's talk about the workflow with Folge. When you create a new guide, you get the option to start adding steps. A rectangular capture area will show up on screen, allowing you to move the corner handles or to click and drag for a whole new rectangular selection area. Now, in Clarify, I was used to doing this click drag of an area on every screenshot, but Folge assumes that you will want to capture many screenshots of that same selected area one after another. Once you've selected the area, you get a pop-up that says Start Capturing. So you haven't actually captured a screenshot yet. You just got the rectangular area you're going to work with. You click the Start Capturing button, and now you can actually start taking screenshots. If you set the preferences the way I like them, a shift click will capture the screen. Now you can click to go to the next screen, for example, and a shift click to take another shot of the same area. Each time you take a screenshot, the pop-up will register it and update a counter for the number of captures you've made. You also get a dandy little thumbnail of what you last captured and a magnifying glass, which when clicked, embiggens the thumbnail so you can ensure you captured what you expected. If you need to capture a different part of the screen, the Start Capturing pop-up has a pause button on it, which will allow you to move the capture rectangle around and resize it, and then you can resume with the pop-up and keep going. This is the part of the workflow I'll have to get used to, because I'm used to being able to do a click, drag, another click, drag, another click, drag, on and on and on, as I've gotten what I've needed. And clarify, using the R key would capture the previous area if you did need it to stay the same, but the rest of the time you would just be grabbing a new screen area. I'm not saying that Folge has a bad workflow, I'm definitely not saying that, but I just haven't yet erased my muscle memory and replaced it with the concept of pause, resize, resume. Hopefully my brain isn't too old to retrain. After you've taken a few screenshots and hit finish on the pop-up, Folge will open to the guide view, and that's where the fun really begins. Down the left side, you'll see thumbnails of each screenshot, or you can make that a list view if you'd prefer. In the middle area will be the step image, and on the right panel will be the step properties. Properties are where you're going to give the step a title and write some descriptive text. We're going to start in the middle with annotations because, let's face it, that's the most fun. Folge has the perfect array of annotations to apply and a very easy way to edit how those annotations look. You've got boxes and circles and lines and arrows and arrowed lines and text, which is, you know, pretty much table stakes for an app like this. But you've also got step numbers, just like Clarify. If you click in several spots on the screenshot with step numbers selected, you will get sequential numbers. Unfortunately, the developer hasn't implemented one of the key tricks of Clarify on step numbers. Ideally, if you delete a step number, the remaining ones should renumber themselves. So for example, if you've got steps 1, 2, and 3, and you delete 2, what you should be left with was steps 1 and 2. But with Folge, you get 1 and 3. So now if you deleted a step number, the next steps are going to keep going. So I'm going to have 1, 3, 4, 5, 6. And that's, you know, that's going to be confusing, right? It's unlikely that you want to skip a step. So to fix this, you have to delete all of your step numbers and start over to get them in order again without any missing. I told you up front that the developer, Oleksiy Shrebeny, is super responsive, and I am sure he'll either enhance the tool to renumber, or he'll explain precisely why it can't be done, maybe why he chose to do it that way, or give me a timeline for when he'll figure out how to make it work the way I like it. After placing any annotation on screen in Folge, you'll get a formatting pane in the Step Properties side panel to allow you to change it. You can change things like line thickness, drop shadows, text size, fill, all those, and more. I do have to say that the step numbers are a bit buggy, where increasing the font size completely messes up the alignment of the number inside the circle, but I already mentioned that to Oleksiy, and he's on it now to figure out how to fix it. I know I get a little nuts when it comes to my love for annotation tools, but the arrows in Folge are delightful. You can change the line thickness and the arrowhead size independently, which for some reason is actually a rare option. Usually as soon as you make the line thick, you get a 6 foot across arrowhead, and that's not what I wanted. In Folge, you could also make arrows expanding, which means the line thickness at the head is big, but it comes to a thin point on the other end. I know that's a small thing, but hey, it delighted me. I've never seen that feature before. I do recommend getting the settings the way you like them on the first annotation you add, because subsequent annotations will adopt that same formatting. Changing these settings appears to change the defaults for the next time you launch Folge. I think that's true. I'm not 100% sure, but in my testing, that's the way it worked. Folge also includes a blur tool, which is essential when taking screenshots to obfuscate private or sensitive information. There's a crop tool in case you want to zoom in on a captured area. When a screenshot is cropped, you get a restore image button above the screenshot. That's good, because remember I said there's no undo in Folge, but the fact that it can restore the image suggests that this is a non-destructive edit. Oleksiy explained to me that he wrote some code very early on, and he's going to have to spend a ton of time refactoring that in order to enable the undo function in Folge. So he's got it on his list, but it's quite a ways down the road, so don't hold your breath for an undo button. The main place I wish I had undo is in the placement of annotations. If you resize one or move it inadvertently, you can't back up a step. You know, it's not that hard to move them around, but, you know, it would be kind of nice. I do have to say that the handles for changing the size of annotations are very difficult to see, especially on darker backgrounds. They're a very thin light blue, and on dark mode screenshots, they practically disappear. Hey, that's another enhancement idea for Alexi. He's gonna love me. In the top bar, you'll see a size indicator, and that's the zoom level of the screenshot, just for your own viewing. Fold has nice keystrokes, like you can hit Command 1 to fit it to screen, Command plus and minus to zoom in and out. In step properties, there's a couple of cool touches. You can do all the normal text editing in the description area, but you can also add links, add code snippets and have them appropriately formatted. You can add checklists, numbered and regular bullets, and highlighted text. But you can also embed a video. Now, this utility is only useful if you have the paid-for version, because obviously a video can't live inside a PDF. This is where the HTML and rich HTML export of Folge really comes into play. If you're feeling constrained in writing your description in the tiny little box that's in the sidebar, you can pop it out into a big window where you can stretch out and get to writing. This is, again, the beauty of it being a web app, because it looks just like the pop-out text box in any browser, so it's familiar and it's very pretty with its bootstrap elements. Finally, you can set the status of a step. You can change it from to do to in progress to done. This will be very helpful if you have trouble remembering to finish annotating every step before publishing. At the top of the screen, you'll notice that Alexi chose a name for your guide. Instead of something boring like Untitled 1, he uses a random name generator, so it might be called something like Aqua Mackerel. If you click on the name, you can change it to something less playful, but perhaps more meaningful to you. Next to the name is a big green export button. Your options, if you pay for Folge, are PDF, Word, PowerPoint, HTML, rich HTML, and even JSON. It says if you export as a JSON file, you can use it to transform your guide into any format or even parse it with your code. That last option is beyond my current skill set, but we've got some super nerds in the community who will probably love that. If we start with the plain PDF export, we have quite a few decisions to make. The most important one is whether to keep steps together and not split content. I say this is the most important because this is precisely what is so hard to manage when working with difficult tools like Pages or Word to lay things out. You can have a table of contents added, you can choose page orientation, and even number each step. There's a handy preview button so you can check out your choices before waiting for the PDF to be created. But hold your horses, we're nowhere done making decisions. You want to decide whether to justify your images, left, right, or center. Choose the image quality and format, and choose the image size. Again, the preview PDF button is your friend. If you want to get fancy, move on to the design tab of export to include a header and a footer and even a logo. And on the last tab, you can even define your own cascading style sheet to modify precisely how your PDF will look. Again, that's a super nerd option, but a super cool option. Folge does what I wish every application ever developed would do. When you export your guide, it pops up a window offering to show you where you put it or just open it for you. I know we chose where to put these things when we hit save and export, but why should we have to drill down again and find it or even remember where we said to put it? Just show it to me. Love that Folge does that. The bottom line is, I have to say that there's no question that Folge is a fantastic option to replace Clarify. You can use it for free, as I said, but I think it's worth the $93 or $69 on sale for two reasons. One, because the rich HTML export is gorgeous. Your final product will have beautiful drop-down shadow boxes around each step and a lovely floating table of contents. And by default, it's a responsive design, so it will adapt to different screen sizes. The second reason is that the developer has definitely put in a lot of work to make this as good as it is already, and he's highly motivated to help make it even better. We desperately need a tool to fill this space, and I hope if you have a need to make tutorials for your friends, family, or coworkers, you'll consider investing in Alexi's work. I almost forgot, there's a business license option too, so if you're going to use Folge for a team, you want to check into that. So check out Folge at folge.me, and if you want to see how the rich HTML looks, I posted a goofy little example in the show notes. Well, with that, it's going to wind us up for this week. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, suggestions, and your reviews like Terry did by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com, and you can follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com. Want to become a Patreon of the arts here? Go to podfeet.com/Patreon. Want to do a one-time donation? Podfeet.com/PayPal. Want to join the community and have conversations? Go to podfeet.com/Slack, where Rick Abram told me about the pencil and the magnet, as we've been talking about. So that's a fun place to go and play. If you like Facebook, we still have a Facebook community at podfeet.com/Facebook. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show and hold down the fort until Kevin gets back, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.